From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Atlanta-based music group TLC is the most successful female group in the history of pop music. A lonely mother gazing out of the window, staring at a sun that she just can't touch. Today, I talked with TLC's lead singer, T-Boz. She's out with a new memoir. First, though, we recently talked with an Athens woman who was once a skinhead and now volunteers to help people break away from hate groups.
Instead of being like, wow, you're just a worthless piece of trash, very likely they already believe that. And saying that causes an embattlement. If you refuse to truly hear someone and where they're coming from, that the tendency is to become defensive almost immediately.
That's Shannon Martinez, mother of seven and a volunteer for the organization Life After Hate. We also asked, do you think the Confederate flag is an essential part of Southern identity? Here are your first thoughts. Ted Barfield tweets, no. Born, raised, lived in the South for all of my non-military years, have never owned, flown, or otherwise displayed a Confederate flag. Matt Lewis says, no other region of the U.S. has its own flag. I don't see why we need one. Our history is so much more than those 4 years at war. And here's one more from our voicemail.
Hi, my name is Dee Dee Del Sol. I live in Beaufort, South Carolina. We're stationed here. My husband's active duty. Why have one to begin with? Why can't it just be the flag of the United States of America? We are in fact, united.
We always love to get your thoughts, so call us like Dee Dee did at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter, of course, and Facebook. Just remember, we might feature your comments on the show. In January, an ongoing water dispute goes to Washington. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments in Georgia's water rights battle with Florida. Earlier this year, Georgia scored a major victory in this decades-long squabble. A special master appointed by SCOTUS said the high court should refuse Florida's request to cap Georgia's water use. I discussed this case with Amanda Riley. She's a reporter with the academic journal Energy and Environment. As quickly as we can we bring us up to date on this battle that has spanned years and years? Basically, Florida is saying that Georgia uses too much water further up the river, and that has dried out its oyster beds and hurt its economy and hurt its citizens and environment, and the special master didn't buy that. Or he didn't buy the fact that a cap on water use should be enforced. Why?
That's correct. And the reason why is that the Army Corps of Engineers was not a party to the lawsuit that Florida brought against Georgia. So basically, the special master said, yes, you know, Florida has shown that it's been harmed by low water flows in the region. And it looks like Georgia hasn't made enough of an effort to, you know, control water use by farmers for irrigation. But the special master said he couldn't really do anything about it, that Florida could prove that a consumption cap on Georgia would actually lead to more water flowing into Florida because the Army Corps was not involved in the lawsuit.
Let's take a listen to Florida Governor Rick Scott. This is from 2013, actually. This is when he was talking about his plans to take Georgia all the way to the Supreme Court if needed. And this audio comes courtesy of the Tallahassee Democrat newspaper.
Because of the actions Georgia's taken, we've negotiated with them. They've not been negotiating in good faith. They've kept our water. It's been going on for decades. Florida's going to file suit to make sure this stops. We've got to take care of the individuals that live in this community, make sure that we get the flow of water coming down here, and make sure we get the livelihood back.
What does he mean Georgia has not negotiated in good faith? What is he alleging there?
Well, Florida has been making this argument for a while, and it's one they made in the lawsuit that, you know, Georgia water managers know, the state of Georgia knows that it's using up too much water, but they haven't done anything. And so they're arguing that, you know, Georgia hasn't made enough of an effort to stem its water use, and that Florida should, you know, be allowed more water.
And there's another party in this. There are a number of parties, but let's hear from the environmentalist voice at least. This is Dan Tonsmeyer with Florida's Apalachicola River Keepers, and he's speaking with WFSU Public Radio.
We're playing with an ecosystem that runs from the foothills of the Smokies to 250 miles out into the Gulf. And we've just, you know, we're seeing it right here before our eyes collapsing. And we've just got to be smart enough to do better than that.
Are environmentalists pretty united on this idea that water use is too high?
I think they are united, yeah, in that, you know, Florida has experienced ecological harm. And, you know, when it comes to this lawsuit in the Supreme Court, you saw a number of environmental groups weigh in and say, look, the special master needs to take into account these ecological harms that are occurring in Florida.
Okay, so why did the Army Corps of Engineers not weigh in on this case?
Well, the Army Corps basically said that they told the court that they don't think it needs to be a party in this case, that the lawsuit can move forward without them.
But the judge says they need to be a party.
Right. Well, the special master, when the Army Corps, you know, said this, and the special master, George actually attempted to get the case dismissed because the Army Corps was not involved. But the special master ruled, I think it was a couple of years ago already, that, you know, the case could move forward. It just means that Florida has a higher burden of proof to show that this consumption cap that it's asking for will actually work.
I'm speaking with E&E News reporter Amanda Riley. We're talking about the latest chapter in the very long-running fight over water between Georgia and Florida. Alabama has come in on the side of Florida. What is Alabama claiming?
Correct. Well, Alabama also thinks that it's not getting a fair share of water. Alabama agreed with Florida that Georgia should have a consumption cap placed on it. I think Alabama is watching the case closely to maybe see what Georgia's defense would be, and that might, you know, influence how it approaches litigation in the future.
This is going to get worse, and not just because it's expected to go to even a higher court, but let's hear from Smokey Parrish. He's a commissioner in Franklin County, Florida, and he actually manages a shrimp restaurant. He says if something's not done, his economy in his area will be doomed. But he is worried about the growth in population in Atlanta. Here he is talking to WFSU Public Radio.
If you can't provide fresh water and you don't have the infrastructure in place for 6.5 million, where are you going to get it for 13 million people? It's a big issue for the people here. We don't have manufacturing jobs here. We have a height limit. You cannot build above 35 feet high. We don't have 10-story condominiums. We don't have Walmarts. We don't have movie theaters. We don't have shopping malls.
So this argument is about growth in the Atlanta metro area. The population here is expected to grow by another 2 million over the next few years. It's already grown. And Florida seems to be claiming that Georgia is not being intentional or putting any controls on its growth. Was this brought up in the case?
I mean, yeah, that was definitely a part of the case. I mean, Florida had to show that it's harm was linked to Georgia's actions. So they had the state in its briefs to the court in testimony at the trial that was held in the case sort of made this point that Georgia wasn't doing enough to lower its water use.
So what happens now?
The Supreme Court has already taken up the case. So how this works in lawsuits between states, the case goes right to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, if they agree to take it up, they appoint the special master. The special master, in a way, acts as the lower court would, collects evidence, holds a trial, and now the Supreme Court will decide whether to take the special master's recommendation and rule for Georgia.
And then once the Supreme Court decides, is that the final end of this fight?
Definitely not. This is going to keep going on. I think one thing we'll see in the pretty near future is litigation over the Army Corps of Engineers' new manual that allocates water for the three states. They came out with an update to this almost 30 year manual in December. So I think that will be sort of where the litigation goes after this.
Explain a little bit more about that manual and how binding or not that it is.
Sure. So what the manual does is it says how much water each state's going to get. The Army Corps operates a system of dams and reservoirs in the area. You know, Lake Lanier is the big reservoir we're talking about here. And so they each of the states weigh in, and then the Corps decides how much water to allocate. The Georgia basically got most of what it wanted in this update of the manual.
Georgia got most of what it's wanted. Let's hear really quickly from Georgia's governor, Nathan Deal. He says that if there were a cap on Georgia's water use, it would devastate his state's economy. He's here talking to WRBL-TV just back in November.
Water issues continue to be important here on the banks of the Chattahoochee. It is our main water source in the state of Georgia, is the Chattahoochee River and the basin that drains into it.
So, I mean, I'm not going to argue with the governor. Clearly, if there were not enough water to support Atlanta, that would be a big problem, especially with all the planned growth. However, does this manual or anything else give guidelines or restrictions on how much water Atlanta can use?
I mean, it does. It does set a number of water per day that the state can draw from Lake Lanier, that Atlanta can draw from the reservoir. So it's this manual is a pretty big deal.
Okay. So will that also affect the Supreme Court's decision or no? I mean,
not at this point.
That's for future lawsuits.
Exactly. Yeah. Like I said, the Army Corps was not a party to this. And I mean, the manual was updated in December after the trial had already taken place. It may have been brought up, you know, by the parties. I don't recall specifically. But yeah, this is going to be a separate issue that's litigated.
When we're speaking of litigation, the other news that we got was that Florida may not have enough money to continue this fight. What does that mean? That Florida will stop setting money aside, or do you expect them to find the money somehow?
I can't give you a good answer on that. I will just say that these interstate disputes, they last for years. They're very expensive for you know,
everybody.
Each of the state parties involved. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So Amanda, what do you see happen? I mean, this is your area of expertise. This is what you cover as a reporter. So, have we any example from past history on how this might turn out and whether or not there will be a compromise which actually preserves the water in the river?
Well, it's really tough to predict here. I think this will keep going on for years. You're going to see attempts at legislation. You're going to see more litigation. In terms of whether of precedent, the Supreme Court here, you know, gets a lot. It's getting a growing number of these interstate water disputes, but it's actually really rare, especially on the East Coast, for the Supreme Court to go through this process of divvying up water to the parties that are involved. I think the last time that actually happened in the East Coast was in the 1930s.
So there
are often disputes between states, and they tend to drag on, and things will happen where they'll bubble up again. Maybe there's some sort of resolution, but it's just kind of always simmering in the background.
Although, I mean, with the growth in Atlanta, to a certain extent, we might have been able to predict it, since Atlanta is one of the few major cities that's not on a waterway or not on an ocean or lake.
I suppose, yeah. And with, you know, with the projections as they are, that the region's going to continue to grow. So, I mean, this will continue to be an issue.
That's E&E News reporter Amanda Riley talking with me about the ongoing, long ongoing legal battle between Georgia and Florida over water usage. The case is scheduled to come before the U.S. Supreme Court on January 8th. Just ahead, I talk with T-Boz, TLC's lead singer. First, though, the new novel searches for a monster in the Okefenokee Swamp. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. America met Georgia author Cassie Beasley in 2015. Her debut novel, Circus Mirandis, became a New York Times bestseller. Beasley's books are targeted to middle schoolers, but their appeal is much wider than that. I recently talked with Beasley about her follow-up novel, Tumble and Blue. It's set in the Okefenokee Swamp.
I'm from Claxton, Georgia, so it's about 50 miles west of Savannah, and I've lived there my whole life with my family, and it's really cool to be from a small town. I really like it.
And your family has a pecan farm?
Yes, so my family farms, and we have a pecan orchard. And it's just a really wonderful place to grow up.
Why do you say that? What do you like about it?
You know, I'm sort of an introverted person. I really like to have a lot of time and space to myself, and that's something you can get really well when, you know, you grow up on a farm. And you can kind of, it's great for a writer as well, because you can kind of go off and be alone kind of in nature and have some time with your notebooks and your pens to just write and think and ponder new story ideas.
And, I mean, there must be something to what you say, because your sister is a writer as well, and she has her own book that came out.
Yeah, so Kate Beasley, my little sister, is a writer, and I'm super, super proud of her. She writes for middle grade readers as well. Her first book is called Gertie's Leap to Greatness, and it came out in October, and I carry a copy around with me pretty much everywhere to show it to people because I'm that proud.
Wait, you carry her book and not your own?
I carry both of them. I do carry both of them, but I think it's pretty natural to be really, really excited when something good happens for someone you care about. So
let's talk about Tumble and Blue, and there will be no spoilers here. But, you know, one of the big themes of this is, I guess, the clay feet of your idols, right? I mean, imagining
yes.
a hero that is not quite as everything you thought they would be. Where did the inspiration for that come from?
So that's really based around Tumble's character. So she kind of came into the story after I had already started writing it. And she's a little girl. Her real name is Lily, who absolutely idolizes this infomercial star named Maximal Star, who sells self-help books about how to be a hero. And she spends most of the book thinking that he's just this really amazing person and she wants to be just like him. And I think it's a big growing moment for her when she realizes that, you know, maybe her hero all along has not been this amazing person she thought he was, and maybe she needs to be the hero herself, you know. And I think that's a big part of the book for her. And my other main character, Blue, is realizing that if they want things to change, if they want their lives to get better, they're going to have to step up and be their own heroes.
Yeah, and it seems to me like another big theme is recognizing what your strengths and weaknesses really are, you know, accepting what you do well instead of trying to change who you are. Why is that a good message for middle schoolers?
I think a big theme in the book is fate. And, you know, I don't believe in fate or in being cursed, as Tumble and Blue are, in the way I present it in the book. But I think it's a really wonderful fantasy element to explore, because there are things in all of our lives that we can't really change about ourselves. And I think it's helpful to explore how people react to things in their lives that feel to them really inevitable. And what I love about Tumble and Blue is that neither one of them is really willing to give up on their dreams, no matter how many times people tell them, you know, you're cursed, you can't ever fix this, this is going to just be how your life is. They both keep trying. And I think that's a helpful message for you, no matter how old you are, that there is a value to continuing to reach for the things you really want, to continuing to strive towards something better for yourself.
So how much do you have to change, or are there things that you have to be aware of when you're writing for younger audiences? I mean, some of the issues in this book are quite, I think adults would say, wow, that's advanced. It's an advanced and nuanced concept for a middle schooler. There's things about trouble with family. There's things about, I guess, putting up with relatives. There's some scary parts. How do you decide what is suitable and what isn't?
So there are some scary parts. I mean, there is a magic alligator in the Okefenokee Swamp.
Yeah. An alligator, kind of.
Kind of, sort of. But so for me, I think the big thing is to, you know, respect your reader. And I think that's important for all authors, but particularly for children's books authors. If you remember being a kid, the things that you worried about, sometimes adults treated them as though they were trivial, but to you, they were tremendously important. And so I think giving kids that respect and letting them know that, yes, you know, your problems really are valid is something I try to do in all my books. And so I really hope Tumble and Blue accomplishes that as well.
What was it, a help to you or a hindrance to be so successful with your first book?
Okay, so it's wonderful, wonderful, and I can't complain. Circus Mirandus was very successful. I love hearing from readers. I think there is something tough about writing your second book and having the knowledge in your head that there are a lot of people who are going to buy it because they liked your first book. And you have to let go of the idea that they should be exactly the same. You know, you want to write the new story. You want to do it justice in its own right and not be too worried about what people are going to think, you know. when they're comparing it to the first book. So just kind of getting in the right headspace for it was maybe a little tough.
How then do you get over that? I mean, it must come from fear, right?
Yes, a lot of writing fear. I'll let you know when I actually figure out how to get over it. So my strategy for writing Tumble in Blue was just to keep plugging away and keep working on making it the best book I could make it. It takes me about 2 years to write a book. So there's a lot of time where you're kind of in the trenches there and you just keep revising and you keep rewriting and you're trying to make this vision you have in your head come out on paper. And so far my strategy has been just to keep at it until I get it right.
That's Georgia author Cassie Beasley, whose latest book is Tumble and Blue. Coming up, I talk with T-Boz, lead singer and songwriter of the group TLC. The Atlanta native has a new memoir out, but first, a good example of the love for TLC. Angie Thomas wrote the best-selling young adult book, The Hate U Give. She grew up a TLC fanatic, and after dealing with serious bullying as a child, she used TLC's music, specifically the late Lisa Left Eye Lopez's words, for support.
I had these two friends in middle school, and the three of us pretended we were TLC all the time. So I was always Left Eye, and they were T-Boz and Chili, and we would practice TLC songs in my driveway. We would play the songs maybe on a little Walkman, even though it had headphones. You could try to turn the volume all the way up so you could still hear it. And we would try to do the songs and the raps and everything and do our own little dances that they would do in the videos. But on the last day of sixth grade, my school decided to announce the students with the highest GPA. And I was a sixth grader, but I had the highest GPA in the entire school, more so than the seventh and eighth graders. And the teachers made the seventh graders feel kind of bad that a sixth grader had a higher GPA than them. So I guess they remembered that over the summer because on my first day of seventh grade, the eighth graders just harassed me. I couldn't go down the hall without one of them pushing me or making a comment about me. They were calling me fatty. They would push me. They would try to trip me, all kind of stuff. I remember looking for those friends that I just had in sixth grade that I was, you know, imitating TLC with, and they were silent. And I get it now because when you're that age, your first instinct is to protect yourself and not stick up for your friend. But I wished that they would stick up for me and they didn't. So I remember going home and just, I was done. My mom, I love my mom to death. And she did so much for me and for my grandmother. She took care of my grandmother full time as a caregiver because my grandmother ended up having dementia. And then us struggling financially, not having a car, you know, having to ask neighbors to take us to the grocery store and stuff like that. It was hard. And for some reason, I thought that the best way to help my mom was if she didn't have to take care of me. I thought that that was the best thing, if I just got out of the way. I had a moment where I just decided I was going to do it. And I locked myself in the bathroom and I was going to take some pain medicine. I, for some reason, took my little CD player into the restroom with me. And I just sat on the floor and I cried. And my mom was outside of the bathroom telling me, just come out, please, don't, you know. She's trying to talk me down. She didn't know that I was trying to take pills or anything like that. But she was trying to just get me to come out to talk to her. And I wanted to drown her out. So I put my headphones on and I pushed play on the CD player and Waterfalls came on. And in that that moment, I decided to really listen to the song. As much as I enjoyed the song, I decided to really listen to it and really listen to Lisa's rap.
Of not one God given right. Is it because my life is 10 shades of gray? I pray all 10 fade away. Seldom praise them for the sunny days. My only bleeding hope is for the folk who can't cope with such an enduring pain that it keeps them in.
She ended the rap with saying, dreams are hopeless aspirations in hopes of coming true.
Believe in yourself, the rest is up to me.
Believe in yourself, the rest is up to me and you. And I remember listening to those lyrics, and it spoke to me in such a way that I decided, no, I'm not going to take these pills. I'm going to get up and I'm going to fight. I'm going to keep going because there's a rainbow on the other side of this. I turned the CD off and I took my headphones off and I went out of the bathroom and I apologized to my mom because I knew I scared her. And I told her, I was like, this song, I told her about the song. I said, this song just really changed me just now.
Well, I started listening to it myself. My name is Julia Williams Thomas, and I'm Angie's mom. I thought about what Angie was had been going through, and I thought, oh, if I could just get Lisa to talk to Angie, maybe that would cheer her up. I called recording studios, record label companies. I called everybody and anybody I could think of to try. And I had some other co-workers and other parents say, girl, you crazy. I wouldn't be trying to call that woman. Well, you can stay in your mode, baby, and I do crazy things, whatever it takes. And so I found the name of her studio that she had at that time, not realizing that was located at her house. So when I called, there was this young lady on the phone answered, and I told her who I was and that my daughter was crazy about Lisa and how Lisa had really made an impact on my child's life. And I was like, if she could just say hello. And the next voice I heard was Lisa Left Eye Lopez.
I was in another room. And my mom was talking to Left Eye from TLC on the phone and explaining to her everything. And my mom comes in the room where I am. I was watching television. My mom muted the television. She said, someone wants to speak to you. So I took the phone and I say, hello. And she goes, hey, this is Left Eye. I dropped the phone. I dropped the phone. And so when I got on the phone, she said, are you okay? And I said, yes, ma'am. And then she was like, oh, you said ma'am. I don't think she was used to kids saying ma'am to her. So I'm Southern. I couldn't help it. And we were just talking, and she you kind of eased into it. You know, it wasn't a thing of from jump, let me talk her off the ledge. No, it was like, let me ease my way into it. So she told me, you know, your mom told me you've been going through some stuff. And she was like, I'm sorry that you know, feel like you have to end it, but don't. And she said, you know, you have so much to fight for. You got your mom, you got your grandmother, you've got so many things that you can do in your life one day. She said, don't take your life. She was a simple with it, you know, don't do it.
And I used to wish that my life would end. You know, my mom would look at me and say, oh, I'm so sad to hear you say that. And if you don't know what it feels like to be happy, you don't know what you don't know, you know? So it's like there's no hope. But doesn't really have to be that way, so.
She said, I'm talking from experience. And it may seem like it's hard right now, but I promise it will get better. I remember just, I was just more so stunned that it was Left Eye talking to me, but still it hit me. And I was like, yes, ma'am, you know.
Lisa said some things to her that really encouraged her in a way like I could never have done myself. At least I felt like I couldn't have. But it made a difference. It made an impact, and it stirred my daughter and encouraged her in a way, honey, that it's like, whatever, I'm going through this and I'm coming out of this.
TLC was the biggest girl group ever. At that time, they were like humongous. So the fact that my mom was able to find the number, the fact that we were able to get her on the phone, it showed me, okay, anything can happen. If that can happen, anything can happen for sure.
That's Angie Thomas, bestselling author of the young adult book, The Hate U Give. She talked about loving Atlanta-based group TLC. That story was produced for the public radio show Studio 360.
Yo, mic check, 1, 2, 1, 2. We in the house. Yeah, come on.
Just ahead, I talk with T-Boz, TLC's lead singer. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's On Second Thought. My next guest became an international star as a member of the Grammy Award-winning group TLC.
Lonely mother gazing out of the window, staring at a sun that she just can't touch. If any dummy's in the jam, she'll be by his side, but he doesn't realize he hurts her so much.
That's Waterfalls by TLC. Their sound was largely shaped by singer Tion Watkins, also known as T-Boz. She grew up in Atlanta and has a new memoir out called A Sick Life. T-Boz joins me on the line from Los Angeles. Good morning, and let's jump right into it. I'd like to start in the same place where you start the book, which is talking about the fact that you have suffered from a form of sickle cell all your life. What changed when you finally figured out what was going wrong?
Well, it's always easier to pinpoint, you know, how to take care of yourself or what to do when you know what you have. But it's kind of hard to figure out, you know, how to make yourself better if you're working in the blind, you know. So I knew I had some form of sickle cell all my life and didn't understand what type. So when I found out what type, then we better understood how to take care of me, and things got a little better.
Well, it just sounds, I mean, the way you describe not only the pain, which you describe so vividly, but also just the way you got treated, because you were basically in and out of hospitals your whole life. And then there was one doctor who told you when you were 7 years old that you wouldn't make it to age 30?
Yeah, and I wouldn't have kids and I'd be disabled my whole life. And I was like, what? You know, usually doctors don't say that kind of thing in front of children, because good thing I had a strong mother, because that could have ruined my life, you know.
So why did you decide, I mean, it was in the late 90s, I think, when you finally revealed that you had a type of sickle cell and went public with it and have since become a spokesperson. Why did you make that decision?
Partially because somebody approached me about it. And then second, I just got tired of all the rumors as well. So it just made sense. I felt like it was bigger than me. Than me being afraid of sharing my story or people pitying me or whatever would come of it. I just felt there was a bigger thing that I could do for other people who had it as well.
You know, it's interesting because I wondered exactly how painful it was sometimes for you to perform. And I really appreciate how open you are about some of that. But you also describe it as being two different people, that T-Boz is in many ways a different person from Tion, right?
Correct.
So did T-Boz experience the kind of pain that Tion had to suffer?
Oh, absolutely. I'm the same person.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I mean, it's just another alter ego of mine. But at the end of the day, I'm always Tion no matter what. You know, I was born that way and I'm going to die that way. But, I mean, T-Boz is just my performance person that, you know, you just basically put on more. It's just a different part of me that I probably wouldn't walk around every day, you know, being like.
But you also say that, you know, you had to sort of discipline yourself to leave that personality on the stage, and you mentioned that not everyone is successful at doing that. Like, what's the risk of taking that performance personality off stage?
That's why I don't like a lot of celebs, because they walk around like they're on stage all day. It's annoying. Like, it's just, like, I know people who don't want to be called by their birth name. They only want to be called by their stage name, or they just act like they're on all the time. And it's just like, if you're behind closed doors and we're real people, like, leave that alone. Like, leave it where it's supposed to be. Like, why are you still on right now? It makes no sense to me. I don't know. They just, you know, brag about money and, you know, all their, you know, what do you call it, superficial worldly items and stuff like that. So to me, it's funny because, like, you never hear John Travolta, who parks a plane in his front yard, like, who has real money, or Eddie Murphy, who's one of my friends. You don't hear people who have real money going around bragging about it. They just are who they are, and they're, you know, content with being them, but they don't have to, like, shout out, oh, I'm rich, I'm this, I'm, like, come on, I hate that.
And, you, I mean, you describe a number of conflicts you had and with big personalities, like with an Aretha Franklin, difficult personality sometimes.
Sometimes, every time I met her. Everybody in the industry is like, she's mean. Like, most people think she's mean. I don't care. That's what I've always heard.
Yeah. And, well, I mean, it sounds like she was difficult in an interaction you had also.
She was, but, you know, hey, I took it with a grain of salt. Like, she doesn't hinder my career, so I guess we just won't be cool. And I'll just like her from afar. But it's sad when you look up to somebody as a child and you meet them and they're totally not like how you would wish they were. So you just go on about your business. So.
And I wondered that on the flip side for you, because, I mean, you TLC is the number one most successful girl group in history. I think something like 17 Grammy nominations, and you won 4 of them. And I was just watching The Other Guys, that movie with Mark Wahlberg and Will Ferrell the other day, and one of the gags they have in there is that the police chief is always supposedly inadvertently, like, reciting TLC lyrics.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, did you see that? And I was it happened to be while I was reading your memoir, and I was thinking to myself, what must that be like? To be part of, to be so much a part of culture that everyone knows if you say, don't go chasing waterfalls or Creep, that.
I know, it's funny, it's surreal, it's weird, like, it's still unbelievable, actually.
Really?
Yeah, really.
How do you deal with it with your kids? I mean, how do you leave the persona behind and then be just, and how do you protect them, I guess?
I just raised my daughter, like, my daughter's older, my son's only 2, so he doesn't understand yet, but
yeah,
my daughter, I raised her normal, like, I want.
What does that mean?
Normal?
Yeah.
Meaning I don't give her the celeb life, like, I don't care how rich my kid was at 17, my child wouldn't be buying no mansion, because that's not normal.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's not normal parenting. I'm just saying. My 16, 17-year-old is not buying a house, even if she could afford it. I don't care. She's 17. Now, it's crazy.
I'm speaking with Tion T-Boz Watkins. She's a lead singer and songwriter for TLC. She grew up in Atlanta. She has a new memoir out called A Sick Life. So let's then talk about your growing up, because you describe it in the book as growing up in Atlanta via Des Moines. You were born in Des Moines. But I wonder what role Atlanta played in the development of you as a musician. How much of an influence was Atlanta on you?
Oh, a lot, because that's where I learned a lot of flavor. That I did in TLC when I choreographed some of our dances. So, you know, I just love their swag and the whole vibe there. So I'm so happy I grew up there.
Yeah, do you come back often?
Yeah, sometimes. My mom goes back and forth.
Yeah, I mean, because Atlanta loves you. The city will always love you.
I just left there, like, probably 2 weeks ago. I had a women's expo that I spoke at. And before that, me and Chili had a sleepover with the fans like a couple of months ago. So I go back all the time. But I want to move back to the South. That's why I want to raise my son.
Why?
Because people are more grounded. Southern hospitality is not Hollywood. It's too Hollywood out here for me. I never liked L.A. I only came here to work, but this is not a place I want to bring up my kids at all.
So, you know, you're forthcoming in this book about so many things. And the things that made me curious were the times when you weren't. For example, after your marriage to Mac 10, there's a part where you actually write, things got really messy. I think what happened between the two of us should remain behind closed doors. And I'm not going to ask you to reveal that now, but I just wondered how that process went in your mind. Like, how did you decide what you wanted to share and what you wanted to hold back?
I mean, for me, it's not hard about what I want to share. I just know it's not anybody's business. You know what I'm saying?
Including your breakup.
For me, I'm not like, you know, when people do reality shows, I remember when we did one, they were like, we'll just shoot it, but we won't show this. And I said, no, we won't, because I know we won't show it, because I'm not shooting it. I don't fall for nothing. like, nah. Like, what I look like, boo-boo the fool? I was born last night. I mean, at night, but not last night. I'm not doing it. You know what I'm saying? So I just don't fall for the okey-doke, and I'm not, in no means, telling nothing. I don't need anybody's opinion or like, rebuttal about something I did. I was there, so I know what happened, so I don't need everybody's input. And the thing that kills me about today, because, you know, I guess the Kardashians and the reality show, and, you know, they have their whole life followed, whether it's good or bad. Everybody doesn't want to be that. I don't care about my whole life being filmed and you knowing my business, and I don't have to answer to nobody. I signed up to sing and dance. I don't owe you an explanation about my life, period. And I'm not doing it. So you could sit there and interview me like if I'm on TV or something, and you be like, if you ask me a question, I'll just look at you and say, it ain't your business. Keep it moving. Like, next question. Because I'm not the one. I don't do that. Because I don't have to answer. Like, why did you? What? Huh? Why did I? Because I wanted to. That's why.
So what do you make about some of the things that are sort of being revealed? And I mean specifically coming out of the entertainment business about the revelations we've had about sexual harassment, sexual assault, the treatment of women. I mean, you were working at a time when some of this stuff was going on in Hollywood. What do you make of it all?
I mean, it happened to me too, but I just didn't take it that serious. And I'm not, you know, some are deeper than others. I think it shouldn't have took one person to say something for everybody to come out the woodwork. Then you got to weed down the people who really have a complaint and the ones who really are just looking for a check. You know what I'm saying? So it's crazy because some people have real legitimate issues, and then there's some people who just want to check and they make up stories. And it's, like, sad because people really, you know, get raped or whatever, and I think that's horrible for you to, you know, do stuff like that, like all these stories, like, this person met me at the hotel and gave me a disease. Like, all this stuff going around is crazy to me. But, I mean, I and you know what's crazy? Because my daughter was sick for about a week, so I had missed out on all the stuff. And then when I pick up the phone, my friends are like, girl, did you hear that such and such that you know is in trouble for sexual harassment and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, wait a minute, what? And then they tell me everybody's coming out. And I'm just like, why is it that when it happened to you, didn't you just come out? Like, why does it take somebody to say something? And you go, oh, okay, even though mine was 30 years ago, I'm going to say something now. Like, huh? I don't know. Like, I'm all for saying it somewhere. Like, I don't know. Maybe that's the jolt somebody needs to speak up. But if you're really violated and you're not looking for a check, speak up. Especially if the person can't get to you, harm you, make you lose your money or whatever, say something.
So when you were writing some of these lyrics, because the kind of attitude that you're talking about right now, the kind of strength, was a lot of times portrayed in your songs. And I wonder how forthcoming you were then in your songs, how much you used your own personal experience when you're writing lyrics. I mean, you tell this, some of these stories in your book. How much did you use your own experience?
A lot, because Unpretty was totally about me.
Yeah.
But I just didn't know at the time that so many people felt the way I did, you know? But, I mean, a lot of my songs, the ones to me that do the best are the ones that are the most organic, that people can relate to.
Came from your own experience?
Not even mine. Like, I'm a people watcher, you know, and I watch people all the time. And I listen to my friends and some stuff I would never get myself into, but I don't judge them. But, you know, I'm like, you know, it's a shame that people feel this way. So I wrote them pretty, but in the day of social media for this album, I wrote Perfect Girls because it seems like kids are striving to be perfect, and no one's perfect. We all have flaws. We all have insecurities. And I'm not knocking anybody who has plastic surgery, but let's be real. The reason we get it is because we want to alter something and make it better or enhance something we didn't like about ourselves. That's why you do it. So at the end of the day, just keep it real. I didn't like my butt, so I got a bigger one. Or guys like it, so I want it to be sexy. Or my breasts were small, I want a bigger one. Like, just be real. I hate when people lie about stuff like that. The point is you did it because you wanted something to enhance something about yourself. What's wrong with that? But just keep it real, though. Just stop lying. Like, nah, I don't have booty injections. Girl, please, your booty's looking like doo-doo plops every other day with skinny legs. Like, it's not normal. Nobody's butt is like that. Like, you know what I'm saying? It's like these girls overdo their butts. Like, these doctors ought to be slapped. Like, why would you do her butt that big and her legs are so skinny? It looks crazy. They look out of proportion. Like, at least if you're going to get surgery, do it right. Like, these girls out here looking crazy, and I would not want to look like that. Everybody don't want to be Big Booty Judy. I already got a big booty anyway, naturally, so I'm good.
So, I mean, obviously, TLC was not the same once you lost Lisa. And I wonder, now that you've been doing solo work, you've been doing all kinds of other stuff and staying really, really busy when you probably don't have to, what has kind of opened up for you? What's sort of your favorite project post-TLC?
I can tell you my greatest accomplishment is
okay.
My daughter.
Yeah.
You know, my kids, raising a human is, like, for me, better than anything I've ever done. But I don't know what my favorite project would be. Well, I take it back. Hold on. I do know. Sort of. Two situations. When Michael asked us to perform on his Heal the World tour and when Prince came and played on stage with us, those are my two moments that meant so much to me.
That's Tion T-Boz Watkins, lead singer of the group TLC. Her new memoir is called A Sick Life. T-Boz, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
And to close today's show, here is the song Meant to Be. It is featured on TLC's 2013 Greatest Hits album, 20.
This goes out to forever. Through the sunshine or the rainiest weather. No matter what, it'll always be us together.
TLC.
I said if I got nothing else, I got memories of what we felt.
And that's it for today's show, but we would love to hear from you. Do you have a favorite song by TLC? I kind of assume everyone does, but what is it? What is the best song that group ever did? Give us a call at 404-500-9457. Feel free to sing if you want to. You can also reach us on Twitter. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.
That we were meant to be.